the turn of the 20th century, American finance ran on muscle and reputation. Telegraphs flashed prices across oceans. Syndicates moved capital from London to Wall Street. The system looked modern, but it had no shock absorbers. And in October 1907, one reckless bet exposed just how fragile it was. Frederick Fritz Augustus Hines, a hard-driving copper baron from Montana, had joined forces with Charles W. Morse, New York's flamboyant ice king. Their circles sat on the boards of banks and trust companies all over town. When Hines's brother Otto tried to corner United Copper stock with borrowed money, the price spiked and then collapsed. Cornering shares is an effort to obtain sufficient control of a particular stock, commodity, human capital, or other asset to reduce competition. On October 19, 1907, the business and finance section of the Evening Star read,
"The downward tendency of prices continued in most stocks in the opening dealings today. Those connected with the copper industry holding their conspicuous place in the decline. 11 a.m. The market was nervous and feverish, and the copper stocks were under continued pressure. Amalgamated Copper falling 3 points to 43.58, a low record for the movement. 12, midnight, the market closed weak at the lowest. The sudden rebound put some prices over last night, but did not hold."
Otto's plan backfired spectacularly. Depositors panicked. Banks linked to the Hineses and Morse face runs. If that incident was the spark, in 1907, the tender lied in trust companies. Lightly regulated, fast-growing, and less connected to safeguards that commercial banks used. Knickerbocker Trust, then New York's third largest trust, faced a run on October 22, 1907. It shut its doors by noon. Confidence cracked, rates on Wall Street loans shot up, more banks wobbled. Into that vacuum stepped John Pierpont Morgan, the most powerful banker in America. He had done this before. During the Panic of 1893, he and the Rothschilds had lent the U.S. Treasury $65 million in gold to stop a run on the Federal Reserves. Now, in 1907, he gathered New York's financiers inside his Madison Avenue library, locked the doors, and demanded balance sheets. All night, clerks tallied assets by candlelight. Morgan forced rival bankers to lend to one another, persuaded the Treasury to deposit emergency funds, and even helped New York City sell bonds to keep paying its workers. When the brokerage Moore and Schley nearly collapsed, its collateral, Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad, or TCI, became Morgan's final puzzle piece. Over a single weekend, he engineered a sale of TCI to U.S. Steel. Because that company already dominated the industry, the deal technically violated antitrust law. By Sunday night, envoys rushed to the White House. Theodore Roosevelt, the trustbuster himself, had no choice and agreed not to interfere. Markets steadied on Monday, but the message was chilling. The nation's stability depended on the will of one man. Congress, uneasy with that reality, passed the Aldrich-Breeland Act of 1908 to study monetary reform. Its National Monetary Commission set out to design a system that could prevent the next panic, or at least avoid handing salvation to another J.P. Morgan. 2 years later, Senator Nelson Aldrich gathered six financiers for a secret retreat. Under the pretense of a duck hunt, they boarded a private rail car to Jekyll Island, a secluded Georgia resort where America's richest families built mansion-sized cottages. Among the party were Henry Davidson of J.P. Morgan & Company, Frank Vanderleep of National City Bank, Paul Warburg, a German-born banker steeped in European central banking, and Benjamin Strong, one of J.P. Morgan's protégés. They drafted a plan that mirrored what Morgan had improvised in 1907, a central reserve that could lend to banks in crisis. The Aldrich Plan called for regional reserve banks to hold member reserves, issue flexible currency, and discount loans, essentially a permanent lender of last resort. Politically, it was toxic. Progressives saw it as Wall Street's coup. When Woodrow Wilson took the presidency in 1913, he ordered his team, Congressman Carter Glass and Senator Robin Owen, to rework the idea under public oversight. They kept Warburg for technical guidance, but rebalanced power. A Washington-based board atop 12 regional banks to dilute New York's control. After months of hearings, the Federal Reserve Act passed Congress just before Christmas 1913. Wilson signed it that evening. The secret meeting on Jekyll Island hadn't created the Fed, but it had framed the blueprint. Now, the United States had an institution to manage money and credit collectively, rather than depending on the charisma or conscience of a single financier. The new system was government-born, but deliberately independent. Its governors served long, staggered terms. It drew no congressional appropriations. Supporters claimed that distance from politics would safeguard the dollar from electioneer whims. Critics warned it insulated power from the people altogether. Either way, a shift had occurred. From the age of the robber baron to the age of the central banker. Morgan's library had been the command center of private finance. The Federal Reserve was meant to be its public successor, an institutional conscience for the market. But its independence also meant decisions on credit, interest, and liquidity would now move behind closed doors in Washington boardrooms, not on factory floors or in city halls. The panic of 1907 ended when one man forced competitors to cooperate. The Fed's creation promised that next time, the system itself would provide that discipline. In practice, it didn't end boom or bust. It only changed who held the keys. Money still flowed upward, only now through official channels. The government had learned to borrow the banker's brain and over time his ambitions. This moment was a hinge in American life. Trust rebuilt not on the shared prosperity, but on centralized control. The structure of modern finance, Federal Reserves, elastic currency, the illusion of stability was in place. The same tools that could steady the economy could also amplify inequality, depending on who used them. By 1913, the United States had institutionalized Morgan's power, embedding it in the state itself. And with that foundation set, the country was poised to leverage this new machine to fund wars, expand credit, and eventually shape the housing systems that would define the next century. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide. In episode 1, we discussed the act of leveling that checked greed, how land went from use and trade to exclusive title, fencing out the commons, how we normalized credit, bound it to the state, then extended it into the home, the introduction of industry, speculation, and status until the seeds of today's housing logic took shape. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Today, we'll examine how a clash between two systems of labor and production ripped the country apart. In its wake, race, class, and inequality shaped everything from who controlled capital to who could own a home. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 2, Territorial Imperative. By the mid-19th century, behind the Industrial Revolution and the growing financial industry, the world was immersed in its next major evolutionary period. But in the United States, civil unrest and turmoil was erupting. There was an economic clash between two systems of labor and production, slavery being the central defining element of that clash. The North industrialized rapidly. Factories, wage labor, railroads, and banking became dominant. Meanwhile, the South stayed agrarian and slave dependent, building crops of cotton, rice, and tobacco. Northerners began to disagree with slavery for a few core reasons. Economically, they believed anyone should be able to work, earn wages, and move up socially. Politically, radical Republicans believed a slaveholding elite disproportionately dominated U.S. politics through the Three-Fifths Compromise, Senate balance, and pro-slavery presidents. Abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, and Harriet Beecher Stowe made slavery's cruelty impossible to ignore, attracting support from evangelical revivals of the early 1800s who tied morality to reform movements like temperance and women's rights. Slavery came to be seen as sinful and unchristian by many Northerners. And finally, violence and instability. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 forced Northerners to return escaped enslaved people, making them complicit. The violence and instability radicalized many, but some infamous public occurrences began to tear the nation apart. Notably, an attempted slave revolt in 1859 known as John Brown's Raid, and an incident on the U.S. Senate floor. After delivering an anti-slavery speech, Senator Charles Sumner, a white abolitionist, was violently caned in the Senate chamber in 1856. The dispute began over a Kansas-Nebraska Act, a territorial policy that effectively repealed the Missouri Compromise, which prevented the expansion of slavery. Sumner alleged that the intent was to spread slavery into free territories.
Not in any common lust for power did this uncommon tragedy have its origin. It is the rape of a virgin territory, compelling it to the hateful embrace of slavery, and it may be clearly traced to a depraved desire for a new slave state, hideous offspring of such a crime, in the hope of adding to the power of slavery in the national government.
Sumner went on to verbally attack the authors directly.
The senator from South Carolina has read many books of chivalry and believes himself a chivalrous knight with sentiments of honor and courage. Of course, he has chosen a mistress to whom he has made his vows, and who, though ugly to others, is always lovely to him, though polluted in the sight of the world, is chaste in his sight. I mean, the harlot, slavery. For her, his tongue is always profuse in words. Let her be impeached in character, or any proposition made to shut her out from the extension of her wantonness. And no extravagance of manner or hardihood of assertion is then too great for this senator.
Representative Preston Brooks did not appreciate that. He confronted Sumner in the Senate chamber and beat him severely on the head using a thick cane with a gold head. Blinded by his own blood, Sumner staggered up the aisle and collapsed unconscious. Undeterred, Brooks continued to beat the motionless Sumner until his cane broke, then continued to beat him with the remaining piece. As other senators attempted to help Sumner, Representative Lawrence Keate waved a pistol at the crowd, shouting, "Let them be!" This event symbolized the polarization of the period. Sumner became a martyr in the North, and Brooks a hero in the South. The two systems were incompatible, and things were increasingly untenable. Each side feared the other would dominate national policy, impeding their lifestyle and culture. 11 states would ultimately secede from the Union. While later generations often debate states' rights as the cause of the Civil War, the states themselves left little ambiguity. Their own declarations of secession made clear that the preservation of slavery was the central issue. Mississippi, 1861.
Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. Its labor supplies the product which constitutes by far the largest and most important portions of commerce of the earth. A blow at slavery is a blow at commerce and civilization.
Georgia, 1861.
For the last 10 years, we have had numerous and serious causes of complaint against our non-slaveholding Confederate states with reference to the subject of African slavery. A brief history of the rise, progress, and policy of anti-slavery, and of the numerous and determined efforts to abolish slavery in the southern states will fully justify the pronounced purpose of Georgia to dissolve her connection with the Union.
Texas, 1861.
In this free government, all white men are, and of right, ought to be entitled to equal civil and political rights. The servitude of the African race, as existing in these states, is mutually beneficial to both bond and free, and is abundantly authorized and justified by the experience of mankind and the revealed will of the Almighty Creator.
South Carolina, 1860.
A geographical line has been drawn across the Union, and all the states north of that line have united in the election of a man to the high office of President of the United States, whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery. He is to be entrusted with the administration of the common government because he has declared that that, quote, government cannot endure permanently half slave, half free.
The man elected to the high office of President of the United States was Abraham Lincoln. He aimed to maintain the Union, but also wanted to limit the expansion of slavery. His election was the final straw for the South. International banks, who had risen to power on funding wars, stayed out of directly funding the U.S. Civil War because it was too risky, while European interests, entangled with Southern cotton, did provide indirect financial support, governments did not formally recognize the Confederacy. The lack of funding forced Lincoln to innovate. His administration developed greenbacks, an emergency paper currency that was made up and issued directly by the United States, essentially an IOU, which promised an eventual payment in gold-backed coin. Abroad, especially in London, investors balked at the idea. Because the notes were not backed by existing gold or silver reserves, greenbacks traded below gold, creating chaos in the market. To calm markets, Congress kept customs duties and federal bond interest payment in coin. Then, after the war, pledged coin repayment and set a path back to gold. This experiment led to the establishment of a national banking system and proved a new concept. Washington could speculatively print money in emergencies. After about 18 months of war and heavy casualties, Lincoln strategically issued the Emancipation Proclamation, undermining the Confederacy's slave labor force and simultaneously adding manpower to the Union Army. About 180,000 black men served by the end of the war, and it reframed the war as a moral fight against slavery, diminishing any full-throated support for the Confederacy internationally. A few years later, near the end of the Civil War, military orders known as Special Field Orders No. 15 were issued by General William Tecumseh Sherman, commander of the Military Division of the Mississippi of the United States Army. The order read in part,
"The islands from Charleston south, the abandoned rice fields along the rivers, for 30 miles back from the sea, and the country bordering the St. John's River, Florida, are reserved and set apart for the settlement of the Negroes now made free by the acts of war and the proclamation of the President of the United States."
The land, abandoned or otherwise, was confiscated as an act of war. As federal property, the order directed the land to be divided into parcels of not more than 40 acres and settled by approximately 18,000 freed slave families and other Black people living in the area. The families were granted possessory rights, and the head of each family was expected to eventually receive title to their property in writing. In the aftermath of the Civil War, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, and in conjunction with the promise of land to formerly enslaved people, freedom became symbolically tied to land. Now, as an aside, Robert Ardrey, an American playwright, screenwriter, and science writer best known for his 1966 nonfiction book, The Territorial Imperative, presented the idea that, quote, man is a territorial animal. The urge to gain, maintain, and defend territory is a force that transcends cultures and civilizations, end quote. He suggested that territoriality is a fundamental aspect of human behavior, similar to other species, and that territorial disputes were linked to wars, housing markets, and urban segregation. Now, there was much controversy around Ardrey's work, largely criticizing that he saw humans as innately evil. To whatever degree, in examining history, there appears to be some validity to at least an innate urge for some in that we see time and time again a drive to acquire and guard territory at any cost. Now, after Lincoln's assassination on April 14, 1865, the rug was pulled as Vice President Andrew Johnson took over the office as president and quickly reversed Order No. 15 by September that same year. See, Johnson was a Southern Unionist from Tennessee. While he hated the wealthy planter elite politically, he was also deeply racist. He didn't support racial equality and opposed giving freed people land or political rights. He saw Reconstruction as a way to quickly bring white Southerners back into the Union, not to transform Southern society. So he offered pardons to nearly all former Confederates who swore loyalty to the Union moving forward. Johnson's leniency enraged Northern Republicans, fueling the rise of radical Reconstruction in Congress. Though bitterly contested, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution followed and was ratified in 1868. It was brought forth to address shortcomings of Reconstruction era. Considered one of the most consequential amendments, it addresses citizenship rights and equal protection under the law, particularly for formerly enslaved individuals. It includes key provisions such as the Citizenship Clause, which grants citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States, and the Equal Protection Clause, which prohibits states from denying any person equal protection of the laws, at least on paper. Yes, ownership of land was equated to freedom, but that opportunity didn't extend to everyone. Back in 1862, the Homestead and Railway Acts issued land titles and fortunes across the United States, taking land from indigenous people and doling out hundreds of acres of land to settlers. This transfer and denial of land seeded a two-track wealth system in the United States. Despite the 14th Amendment, new laws and systems would reinforce this divide. One example was Black Codes, restrictive laws designed to limit Black Americans' labor and economic and physical mobility. While these codes granted certain basic rights, such as the ability to own property, marry, make contracts, and testify in court, they often restricted where Black Americans could live or buy land. By the 1880s, these laws evolved into Jim Crow, formalizing racial segregation that began in the South but soon spread nationwide as Black Americans fled in search of equality. Surprisingly, the rise of one organization and its use of contract law would become the arbiter of who received ownership opportunities in the United States. By the turn of the 20th century, a population boom and a rapid urban migration had transformed the American landscape, and created chaos in the real estate market. There were no standard listings, few licensed brokers, and even less public trusts. In cities like Chicago, real estate exchanges began holding regular meetings to swap listings, early experiments that would eventually evolve into today's multiple listing services, or MLS. In 1908, Chicago broker Edward Judd, president of the Chicago Real Estate Board, convened 120 delegates to found the National Association of Real Estate Exchanges, today's National Association of Realtors. Its founders envisioned a new era of respectability, but their vision of professionalism, like the society around them, drew sharp boundaries around who belonged. Figures like Edward A. Halsey set the tone for order and ethics. Charles N. Chadbourne later coined the term realtor, and A.H. Frederick shepherded the organization through its early structure and growth. William W. Hannon, the first elected president in 1909, in his first address in the National Real Estate Journal, established two major purposes for the organization: survival and influence.
Organization today is an absolute necessity. The best interests of real estate men cannot be accomplished by isolation. Every known branch of human endeavor is organizing for self-preservation, for mutual protection and advancement, and for a common good. The real estate man feels the pulse of the masses. He knows what they demand for the money they pay in taxes for the support and maintenance of their city governments. He knows as well as any man, if not better than most, just what effect certain legislation will have on real estate values, and it is for him to guard against anything that will depreciate the value of property in his community.
But the most notable member would have to be Colonel Nathan William McChesney, a prominent Chicago attorney and the association's first general counsel. McChesney gave the new body its legal backbone. He drafted its charter, constitution, and bylaws, and later authored model real estate licensing acts that shaped state regulations nationwide. A decorated veteran and legal scholar, he embodied the progressive ideal of institutional authority. But McChesney is also known as the creator of racial segregation in housing. He wrote the standard form Chicago Restrictive Covenant, the template that institutionalized racial segregation in property deeds across the city and inspired similar covenants nationwide. The National Association of Real Estate Exchanges was founded on a simple mission, quote, to unite the real estate men of America for the purpose of exerting effectively a combined influence upon matters affecting real estate interests, end quote. It sounded harmless enough, but in the Jim Crow era, no issue shaped real estate interests more than race. What few have recognized, however, was that the association's early strategies would harden not just racial boundaries, but class as well. To protect property values, the organization and its allies championed restrictive covenants, private agreements written into deeds that dictated who could live where and under what conditions. They became the quiet blueprints of segregation, dividing cities block by block. Some covenants were bluntly racist, barring Black, Asian, Jewish, or immigrant families from entire neighborhoods. Others appeared race neutral, but were designed to separate by class instead, setting minimum home prices, lot sizes, and architectural standards that working families simply couldn't afford. In Kansas City's Country Club District, developer J.C. Nichols required houses to cost at least $10,000, nearly six times the average annual income. In Baltimore's Roland Park, deeds demanded grand homes on oversized lots, screened through company-approved art juries. In Chicago and Los Angeles suburbs, advertisements boasted of highly restrictive tracts, phrases that sold exclusivity and virtue. These restrictions didn't say no poor people, but minimum costs, single-family-only zoning, and design vetoes made the message unmistakable. By the 1920s, protective covenants had become industry gospel. Real estate boards across the country circulated templates and academic manuals like the use of deed restrictions in subdivision development, framing them as best practices. Courts upheld class-based restrictions as legitimate tools for preserving value, even after racially explicit clauses were struck down. Many of those economic restrictions still shape neighborhoods today. When racial zoning ordinances were outlawed in Buchanan v. Worley in 1917, developers simply turned to the private covenants to do the same work. And in Corrigan v. Buckley in 1926, the Supreme Court gave them the green light, ruling that such agreements were private contracts, beyond constitutional reach. The result was a wave of racially restrictive subdivisions stretching from Baltimore to Los Angeles. After Colonel Nathan William McChesney's standard form Chicago restrictive covenant circulated through local boards, accelerating adoption, the association's code of ethics went further, instructing members that they should, quote, never be instrumental in introducing into a neighborhood members of any race or nationality whose presence would clearly be detrimental to property values, end quote. It was an official national endorsement of segregation. By then, the organization had rebranded itself as the National Association of Real Estate Boards, and its message had gone mainstream. The same logic that defined what, quote, good neighborhoods were became the centerpiece of the national Own Your Own Home campaign. As we discussed, an effort the U.S. Labor Department would soon adopt and federalize. What began as a professional code had evolved into government policy, mass marketed. Segregation was structurally embedded into the American dream itself. While laws, covenants, and red lines shut minorities and some working class families out of ownership, another America glittered under gaslight. It was the age of the industrial titans, men whose fortunes would come to define capitalism itself. Between the 1870s and early 1900s, the United States transformed from an agrarian republic into the world's dominant industrial power. Railroads stitched the continent together. Steel framed its cities. Oil lit its streets. Finance became its bloodstream. Couched in the language of stability and national progress, a small circle of financiers quietly rewrote the rules of money and ownership. Families like the Rothschilds, Warburgs, Rockefellers, Morgans, Coons, Loebs, and the Schiffs mastered the art of turning credit into empire. What began as simple lending and liquidity evolved into a system of leverage and control. By underwriting governments, monopolies, and railroads, they transformed debt into a new form of dominion, profiting not from production, but from the pulse of money itself. Through investment houses and interlocking trusts, they learned that paper, stocks, bonds, and notes could command more power than factories or fields. Their influence deepened when governments began to treat their credit systems as public infrastructure. Low interest rates inflated assets. High rates punished borrowers. Either way, money flowed upward. Over time, the financial elite shifted from funding industry to owning its arteries, land, housing, transport, and even national debt. Let me say that one more time. It bears repeating because it's a strategy that echoes through time. The financial elite shifted from funding industry to owning its arteries, land, housing, transport, and even national debt. Policy became profit strategy. Markets became managed ecosystems, and wealth was no longer measured by what one built, but by what one could control. In that transformation, these financiers didn't just gain riches, they gained leverage over nations, currencies, and the system of modern power. Andrew Carnegie forged an empire of steel. John D. Rockefeller built Standard Oil so vast it refined nearly 90% of the nation's crude. J.P. Morgan consolidated the country's railroads and banks under his personal command. Cornelius Vanderbilt controlled the tracks and shipping lanes that carried it all. By 1915, the richest 1% of Americans claimed 15% of the nation's total income, a concentration of power and privilege not seen before and not seen again until today, where we're eclipsing that feat with approximately 22% of the nation's total income and holding nearly 30% of the nation's wealth. But the public was beginning to see behind the curtain. Each bank panic pulled it back a little further. The crash of the trust companies in 1907, the liquidity droughts of 1910, 1914, and 1919, each one revealed the same pattern: speculators playing with leverage, banks gambling with deposits, and the public footing the bill. The new Federal Reserve, born in 1913, promised stability but mostly provided cover, another layer between the creators that designed the system and the people living in its shadow. Then, the show went global. After a petition in 1920 signed by prominent politicians, including Herbert Hoover, who had unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination in 1920 U.S. presidential election, economists and, of course, businessmen and financiers, including the same names, Paul Warburg and J.P. Morgan, a conference was convened in Brussels amid Europe's wreckage after World War I. People of the world were exhausted, economically, socially, spiritually. Entire currencies had collapsed. Nations starved under debt. The Brussels Conference, assembled not officially by governments, aimed to rewrite the rules of recovery. Most delegates were economists, businessmen, bankers, or central bank officials, not elected leaders. And that was the point. If the conference failed, nations could deny responsibility. So, around mahogany tables and gilt chambers, the delegates agreed on the principles that would define the next century globally: fiscal discipline, free trade, and sound money. Publicly, that translated to responsibility. In practice, it meant austerity, a set of political economic policies that aimed to reduce government budget deficits through spending cuts, tax increases, or a combination of both. They called for the return of the gold standard, and one resolution declared,
"In countries where there is no central bank of issue, one should be established."
It sounded prudent, even moral. But beneath the rhetoric of discipline was a quieter outcome: preservation of control. Deflation was rebranded as virtue. Austerity became sanctified. And when the world followed suit, the very foundations of modern inequality were laid. In America, that mindset found its champion. When Calvin Coolidge stepped into office after Harding's sudden death, he embodied the Brussels ethos: small government, hands off the markets, and he had his own twist: low taxes. Between 1920 and 1928, the top marginal tax rates plunged from 73% to 25%. Factories hummed, skyscrapers rose, and the Roaring Twenties dazzled with the illusion of endless prosperity. Flappers, speakeasies, Model Ts, and the pulsing beat of jazz, especially for women who embraced new social freedoms. It was a decade that sold freedom through consumption. It was the pinnacle of the Gilded Age. Wealth pooled at the top like molten gold. Vanderbilt's Fifth Avenue mansions shimmered with gold leaf ceilings and marble staircases. Alva Vanderbilt's Marble House in Newport was lined with 22-karat gilding, modeled after the Palace of Versailles. Banquets and ballrooms glowed beneath gaslit chandeliers as orchestras played to halls of crystal and gold. These were more than monuments. They were declarations of divine prosperity to rival Europe's nobility. On the backs of the powerless, they were celebrated as captains of industry. But to many, they were the robber barons, monopolists who crushed rivals, exploited labor, including children, and bent lawmakers to their will. But prosperity was not universal. Mechanization crushed farm incomes, unions were blunted, and wages stagnated beneath record corporate profits. By the end of the decade, the top 1% owned more wealth than the bottom 42 combined. For lower income earners, credit became the lubricant for survival. Loans, installment plans, and speculation in stocks that always seemed to rise until they didn't. See, the thing about excess is that it never sustains itself for long. A society built on imbalance, where wealth pools at the top while the base is left hollow, cannot hold. When a handful of individuals control the arteries of the economy, every beat depends on their pulse. Those at the bottom are left fragile by design. However, when that base buckles, nearly everything is soon to follow. By the late 1920s, the cracks had spread beneath the shine of the Gilded Age. Speculation had replaced production. Stock prices soared far beyond the value of what they represented. The gap between rich and poor had stretched to its breaking point. And then, in October 1929, it snapped.
Nations are perplexed and worried, discouraged and in much trouble. We're turned upside down, people are running around. The United States needs proud, everywhere, everywhere.
The crash was more than a market correction. It was a reckoning. Banks failed, businesses shuttered, and bread lines formed where banquet halls once glittered. The Great Depression that followed, lasting from 1929 to 1939, became the most severe economic collapse in modern history. Unemployment reached 25%. Industrial output fell by half. Families lost homes, farms, and futures. The same rails and banks that had once symbolized progress now carry bankruptcy notices and foreclosures. Keynesian and institutional thinkers argue it was a crisis of confidence, a collapse of demand. When panic set in after the crash, people stopped spending, investors stopped investing, and money stopped moving. Fear froze the economy, and the spiral fed on itself. Monetarists, on the other hand, point to the Federal Reserve. They argue that what began as a typical recession turned catastrophic because the central bank failed to act. As banks collapsed and credit tightened, the money supply shrank dramatically. Prices fell, but debts did not, making what economists call debt deflation. The cruel arithmetic where every dollar owed grows heavier as the economy contracts. Whichever theory one prefers, the result was the same. The gilded world collapsed under its own weight. The mansion stayed standing, but the illusion of stability did not. The Great Depression exposed a truth that still echoes through every boom and bust, that inequality doesn't just divide a nation, it weakens it. Before the Great Depression, the gospel of home ownership wasn't just preached by politicians. It was sold by businessmen. Nationwide campaigns urged banks to lend freely and Americans to buy boldly. Backed by the Department of Labor, the movement framed the single-family house as the moral foundation of prosperity. That ideal had long roots in the American imagination, from the Homestead Act of 1862 to Herbert Hoover's Better Homes in America campaign, ownership was treated as proof of citizenship. Hoover, who was eventually elected president of the United States in 1929, called home ownership, quote, the foundation of a sound economic and social system, end quote. By 1930, home ownership had crept up to 47.8%, but the illusion of stability shattered months later when the stock market crashed. Within 4 years, one in five mortgages had fallen into default, and nearly 200,000 homes were lost in 1931 alone. By 1940, the home ownership rate had fallen back to 43%. As the economy crumbled, architects and planners turned to design for answers. The modernist movement, led by figures like Le Corbusier and the Bauhaus School, envisioned housing as a public good rather than a private luxury. Corbusier's 1924 Radiant City proposed high-rise dwellings surrounded by green space to replace urban slums. Others experimented with standardized, prefabricated homes, an attempt to make good design affordable and efficient. These ideas, though rarely built in their pure form, foreshadowed the social housing projects that would follow in the 1930s and 40s. When the crash gave way to collapse, the system that bound property, credit, and identity broke completely. Mortgages then required 50% down and repayment within 10 years, shutting out most Americans. Desperate to stabilize the market, President Hoover created the Federal Home Loan Bank System in 1932. But it barely slowed the wave of foreclosures. As we discussed, two decades earlier, in 1913, the nation had tried to build a system that safeguarded against just this kind of panic, the Federal Reserve. Created to steady the flow of money and credit, the Fed was designed to keep trust from collapsing when fear spread. During the Depression, its reach was limited, but its existence mattered. It offered the framework for liquidity, the promise that government could act as lender of last resort. Without that foundation, the sweeping credit interventions of the 1930s, the refinancing, the loan guarantees, the mortgage insurance, would have been impossible to fund or coordinate. The Fed provided a financial backbone to a forthcoming housing revolution. A year later, Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office and remade housing finance from the ground up. The Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC, refinanced nearly a million failing mortgages. The Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, insured lenders making 20 to 30 year loans the new norm. And in 1938, the Federal National Mortgage Association, or Fannie Mae, created a secondary market so banks could keep lending. Together, these programs transformed housing from a privilege of the few into a national economic engine. But expansion still came with segregation that was systemic by this point. The FHA's 1938 underwriting manual warned that, quote, inharmonious racial groups threatened neighborhood stability. The HOLC's redlining maps translated prejudice into policy, denying credit to Black and immigrant neighborhoods. Builders receiving federal support were, in practice, incentivized to exclude African Americans entirely. The federal government had followed the lead of the real estate industry, enshrining segregation as fiscal policy. Subsidized suburbs spread for white families, while public housing for others was relegated to containment. While divides over race deepened, the two-track wealth system that affects everyone hardened in plain sight. Mass-produced by an industry built to profit from division itself, a new kind of divide took root. Quietly and legally. By the late 1940s, the image of a family framed by a white picket fence wasn't just marketing, it was a boundary. The home became both symbol and product, the centerpiece of a financial machine that would reshape America's landscape and its identity. What happens when a basic need turned to aspirational dream becomes an investment to guard? Next time on Built to Divide.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
In 1829, the North Portico, also by Latrobe, was added. This was the view from Pennsylvania Avenue. By 1840, one of the many storms broke concerning the decorating of the White House. Congressman Ogle attacked President Van Buren, asking, "Will Americans support their chief servant in a palace as splendid as the Caesar's?" Charles Dickens didn't find the White House quite that splendid. He called it an English clubhouse, with that uncomfortable air of having been made yesterday. Many times there wasn't enough money for even minor repairs. The paint peeled from the walls, and the building was known as the Public Shabby House.